Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. In this hour, after a nearly three-decade ceasefire in the Western Sahara, war has broken out again. What are the causes, and what is the likelihood of a peaceful resolution? Doug Becker explores.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. I'm Dr. Doug Becker, in honor of our First Lady-elect. Last month, November 2020, a nearly three-decade-old ceasefire in the region of Western Sahara was broken, and the war resumed. This territory, the former Spanish Sahara, has been a tinderbox of conflict since Spain decolonized in 1975. On today's show, we explore the root causes of the conflict, why it reignited this year, and the potential pathways for conflict resolution. Our guests are Stephen Zunes, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and co-author of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. He is also the author of The East Timor Model Offers a Way Out for Western Sahara and Morocco This Month in Foreign Policy. Jacob Mundy, associate professor of peace and conflict studies at Colgate University. He is also co-author of Western Sahara and also Performing the Nation, Prefiguring the State, the Western Saharan Refugees 30 Years Later. Randy Irwin, who is casual academic at the University of Newcastle. She is author of Credit Lines, Permanence or Possibility for Sahrawi Refugees. And R. Joseph Huddleston, who is assistant professor of diplomacy and international relations at Seton Hall University. He is the author of Can John Bolton Thaw Western Sahara's Long Frozen Conflict? First, Professor Zunes, could you give us a description of the conflict, some of the history of the conflict, and why is this a conflict in the first place?
Western Sahara, formerly known as the Spanish Sahara, is a Colorado-sized territory just south of Morocco on the Atlantic coast. It was a late decolonization, a good 15 years after most African states got their independence. A nationalist movement known as the Polisario Front had begun to engage the Spaniards in a war of national liberation. The Spaniards had promised to turn the territory over to the Polisario to have an act of self-determination. But the United States, concerned that a left-leaning nationalist movement might come to power, persuaded a reluctant Spain, then distracted by General Franco's final months as he was dying, ended up signing an agreement that gave administration over to the Moroccans for two-thirds of the territory, Mauritania for the southern third, pending an act of self-determination. That act of self-determination never came. As a non-self-governing territory, that is a colony, they have a right of self-determination, I mean, including the option of independence. This was confirmed in a landmark decision in late 1975 by the International Court of Justice. A UN mission that visited the territory at that time showed that the overwhelming majority of the population appeared to favor independence under the Polisario and not integration with either country that was asserting their irredentist claims. Polisario continued their guerrilla war. The Moroccans ended up turning on the civilian population, about 40% of which had to flee into Algeria to refugee camps where they remain to this day. The guerrilla warfare continued. Polisario defeated the Mauritanians who recognized Western Sahara but over their third of the territory, but then the Moroccans ended up taking over that as well. The war continued, and as late as 1982, the Polisario had liberated a good 85% of the country, but thanks to French and American military support of arms and advisors and special forces, Moroccans were able to push back the Polisario. They set up a separation barrier down through the middle of the territory where they were able to hold on to at least three quarters of the territory. There was a stalemate for a long time, war of attrition, until 1991 when the Polisario agreed to a ceasefire in return for the Moroccans to allow for a free and fair UN-supervised referendum. International Peacekeeping Force, UN Peacekeeping Force, known as MINURSO, moved in at that time. Meanwhile, the Western Sahara, which declared itself, the Polisario declared the independence of Western Sahara, calling itself the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, was being recognized by scores of countries around the world. At one point, at least 80 countries recognized an independent Western Sahara. They're a full member of the African Union. But within the territories, there was brutal repression. And I, as someone who's visited there, in fact, yeah, I visited at least 80 countries around the world at this point, including Iraq under Saddam and Tunisia under Suharto. And I've never seen a worse police state than Iraq and occupied Western Sahara. Quite brutal. And the Moroccans failed to move forward with their promised referendum, and presumably because they knew they would lose. The Sahrawis are ethnically distinct from Moroccans, while both are mixed Arab and Berber ancestry. Both are Sunni Muslims. The Sahrawis have a distinct dialect, a unique history, distinct culture, clothing, and the like. They are historically a nomadic people. They like to be free. They don't like to be under the rule of a centralized state like Morocco. They've never had a sultan or imam, or emir. They reject that kind of control. Also, women in Sahrawi society have a lot more freedoms than in Morocco. They have equal rights to inheritance and divorce, keep their maiden names, and they've been in the leadership of the nonviolent resistance movement inside the occupied territories and the political leadership in the refugee camps and liberated zones. But Morocco's continued repression and the failure to move ahead with a referendum, despite the efforts of the United Nations, including former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, who became the Secretary General's personal envoy, led to his growing frustration, a whole series of provocations by Morocco violating the ceasefire agreement on a number of levels, the continued repression, continued denial of refusal to move ahead with the referendum, led the Polisario Front in response to popular demand from their people to resume the armed struggle last month.
And Jacob Mundy, I know there's been some conflict over what they exactly call this territory, non-self-governing territory, perhaps a colony of Morocco, a region. What is the best way to conceptualize Western Sahara from a political, possibly a legal perspective?
This is what I wrote in the Washington Post recently. It's maybe one of the most complicated juridical territories in the world today. So if you look at the UN list of non-self-governing territories, you'll see Western Sahara is still there, along with, all of the British, American, French, and you name it, territories that have yet to be formally decolonized according to the United Nations. The other interesting thing about Western Sahara is it's the only one listed that doesn't have a clear administering power. And there's a footnote that references Spain's efforts to say, hey, it's not our colony anymore. We handed it off in November 14, 1975. Now, we got a very interesting opinion from the UN Legal Counsel in 2002, the highest, basically the UN's lawyer. It said, well, actually, administering power is not something you can give away. You can't just hand the keys of the territory over to another power, right? And that was important because Morocco claims to have the status of administering power. But the UN legal opinion was very clear that de facto administering power doesn't even exist under international law. So then it raises the question, well, what is Morocco's status in the parts of the territory it controls? And you're really kind of left with the term occupation. And there's several reasons to think that this would be an apt description. One is that it's often overlooked. In media accounts, you'll get this sort of story that Spain left, Morocco rolled in, and that's not the case at all. Spain was in full possession of the territory when Morocco began threatening military invasion. Now, everyone hears about the Moroccan Green March, this idea that Morocco was going to march civilians into the territory, but implicit or actually explicit with that was a threat of military force, and that Moroccan forces had gathered on the border of the Spanish Sahara throughout the year of 1975. The CIA sent Kissinger a cable, actually, in early October 75, and said, King Hassan is determined to invade Western Sahara, right? So even the U.S. knew that a military invasion was imminent. The fact that Spain acquiesced to this pressure from Morocco with the U.N. Security Council proving utterly ineffective in terms of its response, and Daniel Patrick Moynihan bragged about this later in his memoirs when it came to East Timor and Western Sahara. So to a certain extent, Morocco did gain the territory by force. And then there's UN General Assembly resolutions that explicitly say occupation. This is in African Union documents that say occupation, and statements of the European Parliament and Court of Justice. So we have it in legal documents, and we have it by the facts of what's going on. So it's a occupied non-self-governing territory, which is perhaps unique within the world today, seeing as Palestine entered into its conflict stage before the UN created the list of non-self-governing territories. But maybe someone with more background on that could answer that question of why Palestine isn't on that list. The other way to look at the conflict would be a classic territorial dispute. You have a semi-recognized state, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, which Stephen mentioned. And then you have Morocco, who are, you know, two states, both vying for the same territory. Just to be kind to Morocco, we could talk about their nomenclature, which is the Saharan provinces, right? But again, the interesting thing about Trump's proclamation is that this is the first major Western power to offer de jure recognition. Now, there might have to be something that happens in Congress to make this official within the US government. It's a totally shocking development that we've never seen. We have over a dozen smaller African countries have appeared to recognize Morocco's sovereignty and the UAE, and now it's the United States. So yeah, this is certainly a sea change.
You're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing conflict in Western Sahara. Randy Irwin, another thing that makes this conflict similar to the Palestinian conflict is a substantial number of refugees that have flowed out of this area. My understanding is the vast majority of refugees who fled the area are in neighboring Algeria. Could you tell us a bit about the refugee crisis, the refugee difficulties, you know, the challenges for refugees out of this conflict?
I think that's one of the most important things that we lose in the conversation about Western Sahara quite frequently. There are almost 200,000 Sahrawi refugees that are in the refugee camps in Algeria. And there are five different refugee camps with Sahrawis living in each one of them. And most of my research and fieldwork was with refugees in the Sahrawi refugee camps. One of the things that I've been struck by in my time in the refugee camps is the way in which the Polisario and the Sahrawi Republic as the state in exile have created a state that manages and governs the refugee camps. They have worked quite diligently to prepare for the referendum and prepare for what comes next. So you have fully functioning food distribution program, you have medical care, you have schools, you have all of these things that you would expect to see in a state. And when I was in the refugee camps, my work was primarily focused with Sahrawi youth, and I looked at their advocacy around natural resource extraction in the territory. So natural resource extraction that was driven by the Moroccan state and companies working with the Moroccan state. And one of the concerns that Sahrawis frequently raised in conversation was the idea that the Moroccan state's presence in the territory and the continued resource extraction in the territory was actively diminishing the sort of future that Sahrawis could have once they left the refugee camps. So Sahrawis have been in the refugee camps since 1976, and this is a desert refugee camp. It's quite hard living. It's hot. It's one of the hottest places on earth. And when you get that hot breeze coming through, it's unbearable. So life has to sort of slow down in those moments, and people really have to take shelter in tents or in clay brick houses that they've constructed over time. But I want to be clear that the refugee camps, despite the length of time that they've been there in Algeria, you know, they're quite well established, but they're not a viable long-term solution. People cannot live in the Sahara Desert in these conditions forever. This is something that Sahrawis know quite physically. The parents of the Sahrawi youth that I worked with were born in Western Sahara, and they can talk about the sort of smell of the ocean and the cool breeze and the ability to move freely. But Sahrawi youth have not had that experience. They only hear about it in stories. And so there's a real desire to experience that, and a real desire to go home. People are eager to go home. I think the amount of time that we can expect people to wait patiently for a referendum is running out. And I think the new announcement by Trump and by the US really changes that calculation in terms of whether or not people are going to continue to sit there or whether or not they're going to push for more conflict and to sort of push the Polisario to make changes and to really advocate and see a break in what we've seen is something of a status quo awaiting for this referendum that has yet to come. It's been long promised, but it hasn't materialized. And I think that frustration in the refugee camps is going to become increasingly significant, especially as the climate warms and it becomes increasingly unlivable.
Joy Huddleston, one of the things about this conflict that struck me is the conflict freezes with the ceasefire promise of a referendum that hasn't actually, you know, that has not been held. But you know, you've described, I think everybody on the panel at different times have described this as a frozen conflict. But it seems like it's no longer frozen. What happened that caused conflict to, I guess for lack of a better term, unfreeze and heat back up last month?
In conflicts like this, and especially with ceasefire agreements like this, no one wants to be the first mover to break the ceasefire. Aside from the actual military conflict on the ground, both sides are aware that they have an international audience. They're aware that the legitimacy of their moves is being scrutinized, especially since this conflict is under the purview of the United Nations. All the peace processes are sort of governed by the United Nations Security Council. Now, a way to think about this is in order for this ceasefire to break, something needed to happen that would give both sides some kind of plausible deniability. This almost happened in 2010. You had this protest camp form in a part of occupied Western Sahara called Gdeim Izik. These big camps formed and the Moroccan military police cracked down. They killed, I think, 11 activists, injured over 100 others. And in the refugee camps, you saw almost all of the youths gathering around the cap. There's a sort of makeshift capital called Rabuni and protesting, saying, you know, it's time to go back to war here. And at that point, the Polisario was able to convince the population, no, hold on, we're using diplomacy to solve this conflict. Let's not break the ceasefire over this. And it worked at that point. But as Randy just pointed out, you have a generation in the camps, people in their 30s, late 30s, who have never experienced the violence of war. And there's a lot of people who have given up on diplomacy. The 2003 efforts of James Baker got really close, right? At one point, every single interested party was supporting the deal that James Baker had put together, had all of the voters Morocco was requesting. It had people from the Moroccan mainland who had, you know, for lack of a better word, colonized there. They were on the voting list. And to everyone's surprise, the Polisario agreed that they could be voters in this referendum. The French government signed on to this. The American government signed on to this. Everyone was looking at this and saying, yes, we're ready to do this. And then Morocco backed out of it. And they presented this autonomy plan that they've been shopping around diplomatically ever since. This is the autonomy plan that Trump's White House statement said is, what's the phrase they always use? Realistic, credible, and serious. It's always those three adjectives. It's kind of funny, actually, to see how long this same phrase has been parroted. So last month, we had a new protest blocking the road in a part that the Polisario controlled, and it escalated to a point where the Polisario officially declared an end to the ceasefire. Of course, at this point, both sides are blaming each other for breaking the ceasefire, and there's a lot of misinformation about it. But at this point, it's clear everyone has admitted this is over. And it hasn't escalated as quickly as some have expected. But now with this statement by Trump and this recognition of Moroccan sovereignty by the White House, it's kind of unclear where this is going to go. It opens up the door for U.S. weapons to be exported to Morocco. There's deals in the work for that. There's a lot of concern over what that will mean for further escalation here. It doesn't change the legal status of the territory at all. It doesn't have a lot of changes, but a lot of legal changes besides this sort of logistical change of Moroccan access to weapons. And so it's still a sea change, a very big concern. But on the other hand, it's also an opportunity for the incoming Biden administration. It's a very low-hanging fruit for the U.S. to signal, hey, we're going to recommit to multilateralism. We're going to recommit to international law. It'd be one of the easiest defensible moves for the Joe Biden administration to make. I think it was John Bolton argued in Foreign Policy a few days ago that this is what Biden should do there.
Stephen Zunes, in the piece that you wrote in Foreign Policy as well, you'd made a reference to Morocco moving into a buffer zone with the construction of a road. Was that one of the triggers at this point, Morocco trying to change some form of a status quo that compelled Polisario to respond?
Morocco violated the ceasefire agreement by going beyond the demarcation, which was along the wall, in order to improve a road connecting Morocco and Moroccan occupied Western Sahara with the rest of Western Africa, with Mauritania in the south. And a large number of Sahrawi civilians, in a classic case of nonviolent resistance, as we've seen in the occupied territories for some time, tried to block it, and it was brutally broken up. Just on Wednesday, Human Rights Watch gave a report about the incident and the increasing crackdown that's been going on in the occupied territory since the resumption. And that raises this whole thing about the repression is something that can't be overemphasized, because Trump insisting that Morocco's autonomy plan is sufficient, you know, it assumes that there will be actual autonomy. Well, if you look at the details, it doesn't come close to what the legal definition of autonomy is in terms of international law. And generally, and given all the broken promises of Morocco and the repression, not to mention the history of autocratic regimes promising autonomy and revoking it, creating, you know, terrible wars. Think of Eritrea, Kosovo. This is just two examples. There's obviously a skepticism about this, and unfortunately, there's been this bipartisan majority in the Senate that have gone on record supporting the idea of this autonomy proposal as one possible way forward. Trump is the first one to really say it's the only way. And what the trouble with Trump's recognition, which took place on December 10th, ironically Human Rights Day, of Trump's recognition of the sovereignty over all of Western Sahara, is that it is, you know, basically given that Western Sahara is a recognized independent state by so many countries, he is essentially recognizing the takeover of one African state by another. And that's a very dangerous precedent, especially for Africa, because the African Union and its predecessor, the OAU, in their charter, they're very clear, no matter how arbitrary colonial boundaries may have been, you do not violate them because otherwise you have, unless there's mutual agreement, otherwise you're going to have wars all over the place. And it also just a broader precedent on international law. There are hardly any cases of a major country recognizing a nation expanding its territory by military force. We fought the Gulf War over that principle. We said, hey, Iraq, you just use some dubious claims of historic ties to take over Kuwait. But now we're saying, in the case of an ally like Morocco, sure, go ahead. and Trump's broken precedent before. I mean, him recognizing Israel's annexation of the Golan Heights and Greater East Jerusalem. I mean, that's a very dangerous precedent as well. Except, you know, we're talking about a whole country here, not just parts of other countries, and so that's really that's why, again, I think that, as Joy pointed out, it's really important, you know, for Biden to basically rescind this recognition, which he could do with the stroke of a pen. The question is, given everything else that's going to be on his plate when he comes to office, is he going to do something about it? But also, because it was tied to to Morocco's recognition of Israel, Morocco could very well renounce their recognition of Israel. So Biden is going to be under a lot of pressure from pro-Israel elements not to rescind the recognition of Western Sahara for fear it would lead to Morocco's announcing its recognition of Israel. But I, you know, whatever the proximate cause of the breakdown of the ceasefire is, I mean, this is very much the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. Morocco has been violating its agreements for many, many years. And just as with Indonesia and East Timor, you know, clear violation of international legal norms, violations of series of UN Security Council resolutions, General Assembly resolutions, World Court decision, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is they have allies on the Security Council, namely France and the United States. So there's no question that the Western Saharans legally are right. The Moroccans are wrong. I mean, that's not an ideological thing. That's just a clear assessment of international law, broad consensus of international legal scholars. But unfortunately, it's a matter of realpolitik and the power of the United States and France to support its allies, regardless of their brazen violations of international legal norms.
When we come back, the Trump administration has proposed a change in the longstanding United States position on Western Sahara. What does this mean for the conflict? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The United Nations is taking up the Western Sahara issue despite opposition from powerful countries. Is a resolution possible? Doug Becker explores.
Jacob Mundy, there's been numerous references to this policy change in the United States. And my understanding of it is that, in essence, the American president, Donald Trump, agreed to recognize the Moroccan autonomy plan in exchange for Morocco recognizing the state of Israel. And so what exactly does that mean? And I mean, one of my interpretations was that for most Americans, they don't know anything about what's going on in Western Sahara. But when the president can say, I have more countries recognizing Israel, it feels like a foreign policy win. Is that a fair description of what the American motivation would mean here? And then what does this change in policy actually mean for Western Sahara?
It's interesting because Morocco already had a liaison office or something of that level with Israel. There's already a kind of recognition there. And if you go back historically, Morocco has actually been a very important, it was called the back channel, right, in the lead up to the first Camp David Accords, because of one, you have a huge number of Moroccan Arabs and Jews who migrated to Israel, and they formed a significant part of the Labor Party in Israel. And so there's always been these connections there between Israel and Morocco at various levels, but at the most elite levels between the monarchy and Israel, Jews in Israel. And so so that's been there, and Morocco's always been kind of, you know, in 73, you know, send some troops and things like that, but always been kind of on the softer side of things, especially compared to Algeria next door, right, in the steadfastness front and things like that. So it's sort of interesting that Morocco, for Morocco, it's a huge win, right, to upgrade their relations with Israel just a tad bit more than they already did, even when everyone knew that Morocco was already sort of at that level anyway. But then Morocco gets this huge gift, which is, you know, major recognition of its annexation of Western Sahara, which, you know, the UN has had to come out and say that doesn't change anything for us. You know, countries around the world are coming out and saying, you know, no, this doesn't change anything as far as we're concerned in terms of Western Sahara status, or that Morocco has no claim to the territory. So yeah, this is probably a lot something that has to do with, I don't know, the Sheldon Adelsons of the world and things like that. The U.S. was actually very close to doing a very similar thing under the Bush Jr. administration, when Elliot Abrams was in the National Security Council and Bolton was actually at the U.N. at the time. But another important factor was the State Department, and that Abrams had been pushing for U.S. to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara in exchange for Morocco coughing up this pseudo-autonomy proposal, which doesn't meet, as Stephen said, doesn't meet the standard of autonomy because there's no provisions within it that protect the locally elected government from abolition by the central government, which is the sine qua non of autonomy, right? So Morocco was going to develop this proposal in exchange for U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara, but the State Department, especially the legal side of things, because there was a political process, right, that was being followed, the State Department put the kibosh on it. But as you can see with the Trump administration, political process doesn't exist, right? If Kushner hands Trump a proclamation, Trump signs it, right, for no apparent reason. Except that apparently James Inhofe had heard about this and was trying to stop Trump from doing this, and they had a big blowout. So this might even boil down to interpersonal politics and Trump's rash behavior, right? There might not even be a strategic vision here. This might just be a knee-jerk reaction, the kinds of politics, the transactional politics that we expect from Trump and that sort of thing. But yeah, I also agree that it might be difficult for Biden to go back on this because it appears to be tied to Morocco's recognition of Israel, except that Morocco keeps denying that this is a quid pro quo, right? Morocco is saying, no, the US recognizing our sovereignty and us, you know, upgrading relations with Israel have nothing to do with each other, right? Because it's bad enough that the Moroccan public in general is very upset about this. And they really have to worry about the Islamic movement within Morocco, not just the legal party, the PJD, but the illegal party of the outlawed Islamic opposition. And so, the U.S. could actually just revoke this, and that to a certain extent would call Morocco's bluff. Now, what does it mean on the ground? Well, when the U.S. Upgraded relations with Morocco in terms of becoming a major non-NATO ally, there was also a free trade agreement that was signed. But due to congressional pressure, a note was inserted that said this does not apply to Morocco. And in terms of arms sales and things like that, in 2019, Morocco was actually the largest purchaser of U.S. Arms at over $10 billion, right? They're upgrading their F-16s, upgrading their Apaches, right? The kinds of tools you might use in a new counterinsurgency fight. And now there's a new $1 billion drone sale with the U.S., right? So as we've known, the way to get to the White House often leads through Raytheon and Lockheed and things like that. And because Morocco had hedged its bets on Hillary so strongly in 2016, and because of the deep connections between the Clinton family and the Moroccan monarchy, Morocco was kind of out in the cold for most of the Trump administration. So it took about $10 billion, $11 billion of arms sales to get their attention. And boy, it appears to have worked. But in the past, there's always been provisions within those arms sales that says these cannot be used in Western Sahara. Now those provisions might be gone if this isn't altered in some way. So in terms of free trade, the phosphates that are being illegally exploited in Western Sahara, right? The richest phosphates in the world, second to Morocco's own holdings, well, at least in terms of exporting countries. And then the fisheries, right? So the United States could be importing illegally extracted resources, right? But that's also Randy's specialty.
And Joe, you were going to respond to that.
I was just going to echo what Jacob had just said about this being any sort of threat that the Moroccan government makes to undo its agreement with Israeli recognition. I agree that it's probably a bluff we can call. Not only because they've had long connections anyway, but because the Moroccan government benefits from this connection, right? This is why I say it's a low-hanging fruit for the Biden administration. It's the legal case for derecognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the Sahara is really easy to make. There's a mountain of international court decisions, EU court decisions saying this is not a legal presence here, right? So if the Biden administration wants to say, hey, we want to prioritize multilateralism over unilateral deal making, we want to put front and center international law over realpolitik and power politics, this is an easy first way to signal that to the international community, right? And the consequences there, of course, there will be, you can't anticipate what kinds of consequences would come from that. You can't really anticipate what the Moroccan government would do, right? Historically, they've had a very sort of cutthroat diplomatic method of dealing with the Western Sahara issue. But it's still, I think, probably one of the easier cases you could make for the Biden administration to change policy from Trump's foreign policy and not really pay a huge price for that.
And Randy Irwin, I would imagine one of the great consequences of a Moroccan autonomy over this area would be any sort of control over the return of refugees. I can't imagine Morocco would be terribly interested in the return of refugees. So does this arrangement spell really a closed door for refugees returning to Western Sahara?
I think that's an interesting question. And the answer that Morocco would give you versus the answer that Sahrawis might give you would be, I think, quite different. So one of the things that I look at with respect to natural resources and, you know, the Moroccan constitutional changes following Gdeim Izik is the ways in which the Moroccan state has sought to fold Sahrawis into the Moroccan population. So the new constitution that was updated in 2011 actively turns Sahrawis into Moroccan citizens and refuses to recognize them as Sahrawi or as a marginalized group within Morocco itself. So in that context, Morocco says something along the lines of, there are no minority groups in Morocco, only Moroccans, and that those who speak Hassaniya, which is the language spoken by Sahrawis, is just part of one of many national languages in Morocco. So in that sense, Morocco has tried to actively fold Sahrawis into the Moroccan state on the basis that there is no difference between Moroccans and Sahrawis. Part of that is a strategic move that makes sense when we read it in terms of a forthcoming referendum, right? So we have to think about all of this in terms of a possible future vote. And so who gets to vote? Morocco has a long history of trying to say, well, Moroccans should get to vote on what happens in Western Sahara. And so the folding of Sahrawis into a Moroccan citizenship is a long strategic path. That doesn't mean that Sahrawis are not routinely marginalized, beaten and challenged for wearing Sahrawi dress, for speaking Hassaniya, for being vocal about their interests. But Morocco would say that that's fine, come back. There's this speech from the Moroccan King Mohammed VI in, I believe it was 2013, where he welcomed Sahrawis from the refugee camps to return. And Sahrawis, on the other hand, absolutely refuse that position, refuse the idea that they would live under Moroccan sovereignty if they haven't yet had the opportunity to vote, right? So there's a point about committing to the vote and then respecting the larger wishes of the Sahrawi population at the end of that vote. So if Sahrawis were to vote to live under Moroccan rule, then they would respect that. Though I've never talked to a Sahrawi who said that and also said that they believed there was a chance that it would come out in favor of Moroccan autonomy. So there is that point, but the idea that Sahrawis would just return home from the refugee camps to live under Moroccan rule without a vote on self-determination is something that I see very hard. I see that as almost impossible to imagine, to see in mass. Certainly there are individuals who over time have decided that the refugee camp is just too harsh, and they make calculations about seeing families they've been separated with for 30 to 40 years, and they return home individually. But in mass, I think it's quite difficult to imagine what that would look like. So I think there's a question there. And so Morocco would say, sure, this sounds great. Sahrawis, on the other hand, I see that as a less viable option.
Stephen, we focused quite a bit of time on the U.S. change in policy, in part because it's happened so recently and in part because clearly, you know, the U.S. plays a substantial role. But who are some of the other external actors that can play a significant role and how might they respond to the shift in American policy?
France has been Morocco's most important backer. France has been the one who has blocked the United Nations from taking action, even in situations like under the Obama administration, when President Obama was ready to push the idea of allowing MINURSO to have a human rights mandate as part of its peacekeeping operations. Currently, MINURSO is the only United Nations peacekeeping operation with no human rights mandate, and this would have given them the authority to investigate and report on human rights abuses, you know, both in the occupied territories, but also in the Polisario-run areas, including the refugee camps as well. But you know, France was very clear they would veto it if this went ahead. And incidentally, Obama was also pressured by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and other pro-Moroccan elements within his administration and Congress to pull back as well. And indeed, he ended up doing that. The European Union, as a whole, because of a lot of financial interest and concern that Morocco might open the tap of refugees, not just from Morocco, but throughout Africa, who make their way up to Morocco. They've been handling Morocco with kid gloves. The main actors in Europe that have made the difference actually has been the European Court, you know, which has invalidated a number of free trade agreements with Morocco that did not distinguish between Morocco and the occupied Western Sahara. When the African Union, of course, has tried to take leadership, but you know, Morocco has generally rejected that. They have taken a lot of effort with the help of France, bribing a number of smaller, poorer African countries that had supported Western Sahara previously to shift over to a pro-Moroccan position. The majority of African states still, of course, support Western Sahara. But I think the most important actor to think about, I think the one actor I think that could indeed make a difference is global civil society. Because when you look at East Timor, for example, a very similar situation that the armed struggle, you know, there was no match to the Indonesian, the nonviolent struggle was subjected to a lot of suppression and the bilateral negotiations, given the asymmetry in power, weren't going anywhere. And the United Nations, thanks to primarily Britain and the United States on the Security Council, but some other states as well, you know, we're blocking the UN from doing its job to enforce its resolutions. Why is East Timor free now? Because the global civil society movements, particularly in countries like the United States, Canada, Australia, you know, Britain, effectively shame their governments into ending their support for Indonesia. And when the Indonesian economy tanked and the big Southeast Asian crisis in 1998, it ended up a situation where these governments essentially had to say to Jakarta, hey, we'd like to help you out here, but this East Timor thing is making it politically impossible for us. This half island isn't worth it to you. You should let it go. And similarly, if you look at the campaign around Namibia, when apartheid South Africa occupied that, and even South Africa itself, you know, the campaign of the boycotts, the divestment of sanctions, you know, played a key role. And I think that's really that is the best hope we have right now is for global civil society to mobilize. Now, most people here in the United States really haven't heard of Western Sahara, but in some countries in Europe, Spain, Norway, several other countries, there is a very active a movement. There is a BDS campaign, if you will. And I think that's really where we need to put our emphasis on global civil society, because frankly, I really can't see any other scenario where the people of Western Sahara can win at this point.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the reigniting of the conflict in Western Sahara. Joey Huddleston, one of the things that has struck me, and Stephen pointed out a number of these cases, that the whole reason why this conflict froze and there was a lack of support for Polisario seemed to be driven by Cold War considerations. They were seen as kind of leftist, perhaps pro-Soviet, et cetera, which is so remarkably dated now. And so many other kind of similar cases, whether it's East Timor or, you know, Namibia, Eritrea, you know, is another example where there's been these successful movements for independence. And the end of the Cold War seemed to open that up. Why has Western Sahara not been, first of all, not really been on the agenda? And secondly, why hasn't there been the kind of movement to support independence, you know, for this region? I mean, Stephen highlighted global civil society. Is that at the core? Are there other issues that we can maybe draw some conclusions about independence movements?
I think that the ceasefire agreement in 1991 actually changed a lot of countries' calculations on how to deal with this conflict, right? What you had was the Polisario Front, the Moroccan government, had signed on this agreement that included provision for a referendum, right? So the assumption there for many years was that there was a referendum forthcoming on this. Now, Stephen mentioned earlier, at one point, we had at least 80 countries recognizing the Sahrawi Republic, right? And what the Moroccan government did diplomatically was go around and say, look, there's a referendum coming. How can you recognize the winner of that referendum before we do it, right? And actually, this is a pretty sound argument in a lot of senses. So it worked. A lot of countries did withdraw recognition of the Sahrawi Republic. And by the way, that's a really strange thing to think about in international relations, to think about recognizing and then withdrawing recognition. But that's been a feature of this conflict here. So since the ceasefire agreement, if you talk to Polisario diplomats, they'll tell you, we're not trying to get recognized anymore. We're trying to get countries to push for this referendum to happen. We have a signed contract, right? That we are trying to get pressure on the Moroccan government to allow this to happen and to stop blocking this deal every time the United Nations comes close to having. Now, of course, since 2003, the James Baker deal was very close to sort of actually seeing this happen. Once that was scuttled, right, you saw a lot of, especially Sahrawis in the camps, they've really like lost hope in diplomatic processes to solve this. So I very much think that Stephen is right, that international pressure from the ground up is going to be really key in generating pressure on countries to push for this referendum. I think the referendum is still kind of the key thing that needs to take place for this to transition peacefully to resolution. But it's really difficult to imagine either the French government or the US government declining to veto anything that actually forces Morocco's hand, right? At one point in 2003, when Morocco scuttled the deal, James Baker went to the U.S. government and said, hey, you know, we need to use sanctions. Like, we need to use the authority we have to make this deal happen, right? We're very close. And the U.N. Security Council and the United States, the State Department, both said, no, we're not going to use sanctions. We're not willing to go that far to force it, right? And the status quo that Morocco has been acceptable to them. They're exporting the phosphates. They're using the fisheries, right? So it's been the status quo of this sort of frozen conflict and ceasefire has been to their benefit, and it's been to the detriment of Sahrawi society in these camps, right? Which is another sort of root cause factor to the breaking of the ceasefire from earlier. So at the end of the day, I think that one narrow avenue forward here is what Trump has done here is really brought a magnifying glass back on this conflict, right? We haven't seen this much written about this conflict in the public sphere in a long, long time. We haven't seen countries coming out and taking positions, the UN taking public positions in a long time. And I definitely think it's a narrow avenue, but there is an opportunity here to sort of get the world to focus on this conflict again and generate the kind of pressure that Stephen has been writing about.
Now, Randy Irwin, you highlighted one potential variable that could compel some form of resolution or at least some sort of actions. And I'd like to ask you about another sort of in combination with that. You highlighted the fact that these are very difficult conditions for refugees to live in, and certainly climate change is likely to have a role in the conflict and kind of pushing for some sort of a resolution. But also, these refugee camps are in Algeria. Is Algeria playing any sort of a role at trying to push some sort of a resolution? Because I can't imagine that they would be all that happy with having these perpetual refugee camps in their territory.
Algeria has a long history of solidarity with the Polisario and Sahrawi refugees. They are quite vocal about the Sahrawi right to self-determination. And they've also recognized the Sahrawi state in exile as sovereign. So as we heard earlier, there is some international recognition of that Sahrawi state in exile, which has had some, created some legal avenues for Sahrawis in general, right? We see that in South Africa, in a legal case in South Africa, where Sahrawis were able to reclaim the phosphates. But in the context of Algeria, the Algerian state has allowed Sahrawis and the Polisario to really self-manage those refugee camps and has created a bit of an autonomous space for the Polisario. So it's quite hands-off in that sense, and Algeria is quite committed to non-intervention in the refugee camps as a marker of respect for Sahrawi sovereignty, even though it is on Algerian land. But on a both international level and on a domestic level, that's about solidarity and Algerian support for raising the profile of the Sahrawi cause. So one of the things that we just talked about was that the conflict in Western Sahara has been pushed aside for a long time because it's gone quiet. And now with Trump's announcement, it's back on the map. One of the things that the Algerian state has sought to do for a long time is to prevent Western Sahara from going quiet. So frequently you'll find instances of Algerian representatives speaking about Western Sahara or bringing Sahrawi representatives with them to meetings in order to keep that conflict alive and to keep that knowledge alive. But there's a lot of independence and solidarity. So it's not that the Algerian state, I think, that yes, they would love for Sahrawis to not be there in the sense that then they could go home. But I think the Algerian state has been quite committed and proven themselves is quite committed to the rights of Sahrawis to self-determination and not pushing Sahrawis out of the refugee camps in order to just get them off of Algerian land. This is much more about a longer anti-colonial history of the Algerian state and seeking to do what's right by colonized countries.
So we've got a scenario where this is back in the headlines, it's being discussed, and even though the U.S. position may be pushing a little bit further away from some sort of resolution, there's certainly a resolution that would result in an independent Western Sahara. We've got this possibility for some form of resolution, or at least people are paying attention. So Jacob Mundy, I'm going to give you the last word, and we've got about 90 seconds left. Do you think a resolution of this conflict is possible anytime soon, or is it just moving further away from resolution?
Well, I've argued for some time that the international community wasn't going to do anything about this unless a crisis were to emerge. Like Joey was saying, there's been this fantasy, this make-believe around the Western Sahara peace process since they abandoned the second Baker Plan in 2003, which was the pursuit of a mutually agreed political solution that would be self-implementing, self-guaranteeing, self-regulating, that sort of thing. As if autonomy wouldn't require a large international peacekeeping force to make sure that the autonomy was respected, right? So this idea that if we just sit Polisario and Morocco down together and they will agree to something that will provide for self-determination is never going to happen. First of all, because in 2001, Morocco said self-determination, a referendum on independence is off the table. That's it, right? And yet resolution after resolution has called for a mutually agreed political solution that will provide for self-determination. So what do you do when one of the parties to the conflict rejects the entire premise of the peace process, right? And that's been the sort of strange fiction that we've been living under for a long time. Polisario, in resuming armed struggle, you know, at first they tried to draw attention to the infrastructural improvements, the road connecting the border with Mauritania. That didn't work, so they've resumed armed struggle. And unfortunately, that has gotten very little attention until Trump's proclamation. So is Polisario willing to escalate military tensions to get the attention that's necessary to resolve this issue? That remains to be seen. But as Stephen said, I think there's another, you know, international force out there, which is, you know, global civil society, which could, you know, by highlighting this issue, raising awareness and bringing pressure to bear in certain ways. You know, one of the really important legal cases was brought by the Western Sahara campaign in the United Kingdom that resulted in a very positive verdict, right? And when Western Sahara is brought to an international legal forum, it never loses, right? So that's what I think is working in Western Sahara's favor.
We've been discussing the conflict in Western Sahara and the potential for a resolution. Our panel today has been Stephen Zunez, professor of politics at the University of San Francisco and co-author of Western Sahara, War, Nationalism, and Conflict, Irresolution. His co-author, Jacob Mundy, associate professor of peace and conflict studies at Colgate University. Randy Irwin, who is casual academic at the University of Newcastle. She is the author of Credit Lines, Permanence or Possibility for Sahrawi Refugees. And R. Joseph Huddleston, who is assistant professor of diplomacy and international relations at Seton Hall University. He is the author of Can John Bolton Thaw Western Sahara's Long Frozen Conflict?
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.